on this episode of Pottages.
I know that I found the heartfelt moments here more heartfelt than anything in Try. There are consequences. Crazy.
Consequences.
It's a consequence.
Woke Tai Chi, 2018.
Woke Tai Chi. I wouldn't go that far. But
he's woke enough to realize that if you destroy Odaiba, some people might be inconvenienced.
Joe!
Joe.
Joe!
I need your password. You can use mine to get on the internet.
I did this.
Welcome to Pottages, episode T801, On Stage Chemist Try.
Super Evolution Stage, Digimon Adventure Try, August 1st Adventure.
Recorded August 1st, 1999. I mean, recorded January 7th, 2018.
Anyway, Pottages is your critically nostalgic analytical tour through the Digimon anime and random media productions related to the Digimon anime. I'm your host, Jeff Ruberg, and I'm joined by Ashley McDonald.
Yes, but the name Knife of Day.
Asher Soffman.
Okay, are we going to talk about our crushes now?
And Andrew Soffman.
I give it a B.
Today, we're doing a special episode discussing the Try stage play, which was released on DVD last month. I don't know when this episode will be going out, but that was released in December. And I just want to, before we get into our impressions, I want to explain that this is a weird podcast format. We normally are covering things that people, that came out a long time ago, or they're a new Try movie that everyone, we assume, they're not going to come listen to this unless they've already watched it, or there's no reason to, like, there's no reason for them to just not go watch it as soon as it comes out. But this is something that's like a weird thing that might not be on everyone's radars, so we kind of, I kind of assume that people might be interested in listening to our reactions and impressions and review of the stage play, even if they haven't watched the thing itself. So we're going to split it into a spoiler-free review, which you can listen to decide if you want to watch the thing, and our spoiler-full discussion, which come back after you've watched the stage play and listen to that, and, you know, don't listen to that until you've already watched the thing. So before we go into our impressions, I do want to explain how to watch this. There is no official English release. There is a fan sub, which you can find. We're not going to link to it on the site, on the podcast site. But if you search for great-blaster.tumblr.com or search for Onkei-kun, who is the fan subber, then you can find it. And that is basically the release we'll be discussing, because we all watched fan subs and we don't understand Japanese well enough. I tried to watch it without subs from the DVD, which I own, and did not. I understood some things, but So that's what we'll be discussing primarily. But if you do want to do the right thing and actually purchase the thing and not do shady, ethically and legally bleh things, you can buy the DVD. There are no subtitles or captions of either English or Japanese on there. It's all just video. And we'll have links to the Amazon and CD Japan pages where you can go buy that. Ordering from Amazon Japan, if you have never done that before, is really easy. You do need to make a new account. You can't use your local country account, but making an account is pretty easy, and you can switch the language to English and everything. And CD Japan is also pretty easy, but it's a little bit more expensive than Amazon Japan usually. We'll have a link in the show notes to a blog post that kind of describes how to sign up on Amazon Japan and how to order things on Amazon Japan, which should help you if that is how you want to purchase the DVD. And the DVD also includes the DVD includes two discs, and the first disc is what has been fan subbed. And the second disc is a bunch of extras, behind the scenes, making of kind of stuff. It's not like a highly curated documentary kind of style thing. It's more of a bunch of random footage they took while rehearsing and stuff. And there are a couple things where they're actually talking to the video camera, but most of it is just watching them rehearse and stuff. But it's interesting to watch and is not released in any other way aside from getting the DVD. So you should go do that. And we don't normally cover new stuff that is unlicensed like this. The primary thing that's like this that I decided not to cover in this way is Atmon, because I think that if we promote stuff that is unlicensed and has a chance of being licensed, that discourages, has the possible effect of discouraging licensors from picking it up, because the more something has been spread and consumed through non-official means, means that, you know, like that is a sign of popularity, but it's also a sign that people have already consumed it and means that licensors might be less interested in getting it. So that's why I've been hesitant to cover Atmon. But stage plays are such a strange thing. I don't think there have been any that have been officially licensed. Maybe the Sailor Moon musicals, I think, have had releases, maybe. But so it's not something that really has a possibility of being licensed, which is why we're covering it this way. So, yeah, let's get into the show. Now we're going to dive into our spoiler-free impressions, but I do want to caution that there are two different...
Jeff has to explain what a spoiler is.
There are two different layers of spoilers to this, because there were definitely stuff that I knew before watching it that were just from watching the news or like hearing the news about the stage play and stuff. And there's stuff that if you look at the list of cast are obvious, but I think we should assume that for the purpose of the discussion, don't take those things for granted. Like, don't say any of that kind of stuff. Basically, there is a villain who is treated on par with the main eight kids, and just don't say who that is. So
silly, but sure.
Well, I thought, like, having gone in not knowing literally nothing except that there was a stage play, I will say that seeing who that villain was like a joyful surprise for me. So I respect that.
All right, Ash, can you read the synopsis?
The date of August 1st is a special one to Yamato, Taichi, and the other chosen children. While Taichi is busy with soccer practice, Hikari suggests that everyone should go camping together on August 1st. However, Mimi has forgotten the camping equipment, so the excursion gets off to a rough start. The feelings of 6 years ago resurface, and the August 1st camping trip really gets started. However, that camping site has a secret.
Ooh.
Now I have made
some. I'm so tempted to say
opening.
The secret.
Made some openings stuck in my head. Donna, please, can you keep my secret?
I had this stuck in my head too, right?
Wait, what is that from?
Maid-sama.
Kaichawa Maid-sama.
Okay, yeah. Before we go on a Maid-sama tangent, what do we think of this thing?
Oh, it was so much fun! I was so happy.
I was smiling the entire time.
Right? This is the try we deserve. Oh, I can't believe I sat through how many episodes of crap, and when I could have just had 2 hours of this pure joyful moment.
I don't have strong feelings like that. I watched it and it was like pretty good. I think the problem is that I don't like plays, probably.
Like, I was a theater kid, so this was like,
yeah, exactly,
really great for me. Yeah.
So actually, I'm so like, Andrew. Oh, so plays are all telling. Just tell me everything.
All plays, but yes, to a greater degree than TV.
Yes and no.
There are more shortcuts that need, not shortcuts, but like there's more gesturing rather than like making the thing happen. There's just more limitations on a stage.
Yeah, it's harder to show.
Yeah, I get that, but I'm just like, these are just people talking at me for 2 hours and 10 minutes.
So there's a lot of talking and try.
Yeah, that, but try sucks. That doesn't prove anything.
Well, at least I don't know if you guys would agree with me, but like I find the characterization in this miles above anything that Try has given us, even from the beginning. Like Try is not internally consistent, but this is not only mostly internally consistent, but it also is consistent with what we know of the kids from previous seasons.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this makes much sense.
Yes. My impression is that I wasn't like grinning from ear to ear throughout the entire thing, like Andrew and Asher, I guess, but I do think
what is wrong with you people?
it was surprisingly heartfelt and introspective. And I think by taking the larger Try elements out of the equation, AKA like Mako, Maki, Daigo, all that kind of stuff, it's left focusing on the character interactions, which is what we all wanted out of Try and hoped would be in Try and haven't really been that much. And like, It's like the stage play executed little character beats really well. Like, I don't think like there are just so many little things that executed really well that, like, in comparison, I feel like the Tri-Films have maybe like once per film had one little moment that was like a nugget of greatness. And this stage play had like several of those nuggets, like on par with like Tai Chi's I Understand Less the More I Know from chapter one, or Joe and Mimi's Exchange chapter two, or Takaru hugging Patamon chapter three, like on par with those things, but just like several of those in one thing, which was great.
I mean, I don't remember any of those things. So I would say that perhaps, I mean, depending on what touches you, I know that I found the heartfelt moments here more heartfelt than anything in Try. And I think part of that might actually be due to the nature of a stage play, in which there's by nature there are sort of there's more an actor can bring to that role, more interaction. I don't know too much about how like TV animation is recorded, but I know a lot of it is like you're in a room by yourself for sound purposes. Yeah. And here
that's general. I'm not sure how it differed for this kind of like a movie production, but the way anime voice acting is typically done is everyone in a room together.
Or at least the principal cast.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh. And they do it to like not the final art, but like the rough.
Yeah, like placeholder
rough
stuff.
Draft.
That's another thing I was thinking, though, is that so much is on the animators in an animated show. Whereas here, each character has one person, well, sort of
two,
one and a half people. I mean, is a Digimon part of the person or part of or their own thing?
I don't know, but there was a scene early on where Patamon's puppeteer was emoting, and I was like, he was just like,
no,
oh my
the
god,
puppeteers
you're so
were the best part. What the puppeteers are you talking about?
Yeah, you know, the puppeteers emote throughout. They talk, or they don't talk, but their mouths move.
Yeah, their mouths
along with
move,
the dialogue,
yeah, so they know what to do, presumably. Yeah.
No, but they were so into it.
They were absolutely. That's why they were the best. Like, hands down.
But before we go into the puppeteers some more, I think we should talk about the puppeteers, because I think that's a general like thing that people who have not watched it might be interested about. Like, how are the puppets? Because that was definitely my biggest like, ooh, this puppet thing seems a little sketchy. But before we get into that,
can we not mention later puppet?
We can do that in the spoiler section.
Okay.
Yeah. The last thing I want to mention, the general impressions, is that like this is very, very meta. That's probably standard for stage plays, since it's like it's a totally different form and it's not really like probably generally
it's
not canonical.
More impressionistic.
I guess so. I just think it's more like it's more fan servicey in general. So like obviously I'm gonna throw in this kind of like meta fan service, but there's lots of great meta moments in this to look forward to if that is the kind of humor
absolutely
and stuff you like. But yeah, onto the puppets. I thought it was interesting, like this is kind of spoiling the opening sequence, but it basically opens with like Agumon not being used to moving as a puppet and like struggling to move as a puppet.
It's a nice commentary.
And I think it was also like there to kind of like teach the audience to get used to the puppets, which that was pretty interesting. And I actually
it didn't
was really
work
confused
for me. It didn't work for
yeah
me. But
I don't think I ever really got used to them. But
no, I loved them.
I loved the puppeteers a lot more than I loved the puppets.
Patamon's puppet is, I was like, that puppeteer is cheating. He has the easiest one, and I love it. I love everything.
Patamon's puppet, I actually don't know if it was easy, because like he had to move it, or the puppeteer had to move it up and down constantly to make the wings flap.
Yeah, no, it was, I think it was still easier.
I guess so.
I don't know.
That's the one I can specifically remember the anatomy, because I know it was like two different pieces. It was like basically a head and a body, and then move them left to right, and then up and down to the wing flap. The other ones I don't remember. They're more complicated.
Yeah, for the most part, it seemed like there was the hands, basically. You had a thing for each hand, and I think some sort of vague control over the body.
I guess I expected going into it that the puppeteers would eventually eventually not notice them anymore, and they'd they disappear into the background, but that never happens.
Opposite.
Yeah.
but they were so good. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think it's, so like I wrote down my notes, like the puppeteers are always visible, almost intentionally so. So like, in addition to like the emoting, there are times where the body emphasis, the emphasis added by the bodies of the puppeteers actually adds context. Like there's one moment when Agumon is like struggling to walk and the puppeteer is like making big stomping motions that are like more exaggerated than Agumon is. And
yeah, there's another part where like Gabumon is tired and the puppeteer just like flops and it's great. It's so good because the puppets themselves are very limited in what they're able to convey because their faces don't move. Because
they're cheap.
They're not. They are not cheap.
Yeah.
Puppets are not cheap, my friend. And there were a lot of puppets there.
Well, compared to like a
Broadway. They got some real elaborate puppets eventually.
I mean, so they are, regardless of how much money they actually cost to make, they look cheap. Like they look hokey, and like if you're expecting something that looks super high quality, they're not that.
Like but, the Lion King.
What would did that take to do though? Like
it would take
a
like,
robot.
No.
A small child inside of a puppet.
No, the Lion King has some really cool examples of that. If you would like to see that. It takes a Broadway budget for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a crazy person.
Yeah, I don't know who did the Lion King's puppets. That was
the same person who did the Spider-Man Broadway thing.
That doesn't help me.
Anyway, but I think that like emphasis that the puppeteers add, like I kind of thought of it as like visual sound effects. Like I'm thinking like sound effects in like manga panels or comic panels. It's like a little blam, but it's like just like showing like, yeah, they can show much more movement and range of like, not emotion, but
yes, emotion.
Yeah.
So basically JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
The puppeteers are JoJo.
Joe.
And there are times where you notice they're just like, I guess like Patamon's puppeteer is most obvious, just like smiling and cheering along the whole time. It's like, oh God.
Even what they wore reflected whose Digimon they were. Like Patamon's puppeteer was wearing shorts because TK is the kid. I'm forgetting some of the rest of them because that was the one that stuck out to me.
I didn't even notice that.
I didn't even notice that either.
I was noticing stuff like that, obviously.
Ash was all like, I did theater.
I'm trying to remember which. Oh, I think it was Patamon and Takaru that like, there's a moment where all the kids and their Digimon are like kind of like having a little intimate moment. But I think because Patamon sits in Takaru's lap, the puppeteer is like awkwardly like looking into Takaru's eyes because he's like holding Patamon over him. I was like, okay, this is creepy. They were like face to face, like about to kiss, but like.
No, I definitely was like, I feel like the puppeteers have a romance with each of the children.
Okay, so I don't know if Jeff did this or possibly Andrew, but I watched the five curtain calls they did.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I should explain that.
I did
the
too.
DVD one has like so the thing is 20. Two hours and like 8 minutes or so, and then there's like 20 minutes of like every curtain call after every performance, I guess.
Is
that
normal.
What that was?
I think the first one was the last one, and then they kept showing the other ones.
No,
but no, they really have left,
and they kept coming out. They come out like six times.
Yes. Yes.
That's a thing people do.
They made reference to it. They were like, and we already did the clap, and they for real kept coming out.
Oh, okay. I was skipping through them at that point.
All of this.
Yeah,
you did not have to, but I wanted to like show my appreciation in a way that they
stay after the credits.
I feel bad for the audience that had to stand the whole time through all of them.
The audience doesn't have to stand for the whole time. Like,
well, I mean, anyway. It's really rude to leave.
No. People do.
Yeah,
it's one way to get out of the parking lot.
Hmm.
Yeah, but like I just wanted to say that like the puppeteers and the actors of the children that they worked with, like there was a sense of partnership there.
Oh,
at least
totally.
According to them.
Yeah, and like even so there's that curtain call stuff that's on DVD one, which is what has been fan subbed, and I watched I'll get into more highlights of the extra DVD when we do our spoiler discussion. But yeah, there's tons of stuff you get from that like them just like joking around together and stuff. So they do seem, and they're like, oh, they're my partner, blah, blah, blah.
It's like they spend hours with each other practicing.
So the second to last thing I want us to tackle in the spoiler free section is an obvious question, I guess. Should people watch it?
Yes.
Ashley is notably quiet.
I'd go with yes, but I still feel frustrated that like it adds another layer to the tri-canon that is nonsense. But sure, like
what Tri-Canon.
Tri's already nonsense, so go watch it, I guess.
No, just watch this. Ignore the rest of Tri.
Just, yeah, yeah, that's how I feel.
that is possible. That's a thing you can do. True.
Stop watching Tri. Don't watch the last Tri movie. Just watch the stage play.
I cannot imagine how the last episode of Tri is going to resolve anything as nicely as this resolved itself.
As nicely as this resolved their internal character conflicts, yeah.
Yeah. Or didn't, as the case may be.
So my recommendation hinges on like how much you're willing to accept hokiness and silliness. Because like if that is like a deal breaker for you, and like seeing puppets that look cheap, whatever, like, and if that kind of thing never really that never fading like bothers you the whole time, you probably might not enjoy it. But if you're able to accept any level of hokiness, I think, and it's also just like the character. Like, it's a stage production. It's a, not like a high art Broadway kind of stage production. So, like, the characters are very emphatic, over the top. Like, they shout things when they're being whatever. Like, they're...
Tai Chi just talks like this.
I thought in particular...
That's my one criticism.
Tai Chi and Joe, too, both, like, shouted everything.
Joe is great. You shut the heck up.
My problem was with Tai Chi and Matt is, like, they go from 0 to 60 emotionally and only in one direction.
Yeah, so. Yamato is one point where he, like, first of all, his eyes throughout the entire thing were just, like, piercing into everything. And I was like, oh, my God, your eyes, calm down.
Knife of day.
but also like one point he's like frustrated or something and just like throws his whole like torso down, like bends down and is like, oh my God, you're just like, there's no nuance in the performance at all. And if that's something you're not okay with, then you might not enjoy it. But if you just enjoy the fun and you're along for the ride, then it's great. And they do really embody the characters. Even if they're not like, there's not lots of nuance in the performance, like they, by the end of it, there was no, like you don't see past the puppeteers, but you definitely are like, well, that is Joe. That is Yamato. That is Tai Chi.
I was definitely fully accepting. I was like, yes, you are Joe. I agree.
But is he Joe?
Part of it's to say that like he stole the show. Like,
well, you know what? For once, I agree with you about Joe.
Thank you.
Okay, so
I am living. I am alive.
Like it the most. Joe was the best character. It's just
absolutely.
So Andrew, is Joe your MVP as well?
Yes.
I feel like I'm kind of undecided because like I do agree, like thinking about it, that Joe had lots of great stuff, but I don't think my initial impression afterwards was like Joe was the best part by far.
Well, then you're wrong.
I mean, it's Joe and then Patamon for me.
Hikaru did some good work too. I really liked Hikaru.
True. Hikaru was my third. I had a ranking.
I actually like Sora too, but I noticed
what? I have no qualms with her actress. I feel like the writers still could have pushed more with Sora. This is an ongoing Sora problem for the last 3 seasons of Digimon. Anyway,
well, then again, I'm also familiar with the actress.
Oh, that's what it is.
Ooh, ooh la la.
Ooh, you're familiar with her, are you?
She's in one of the Sentai series.
I guess I will go with Joe. Like, I don't have anyone else that stood out as much, and he had the most, like, I want to go in the spoiler section into like the moments I thought were great from the characters, and he had the most moments of anyone.
Yes, he did.
Man, is this going to count for a fantasy draft? Because people are going to...
No. I mean, yeah, we should take... People will vote on Saber's characters, and they'll be like, no, it was all Joe. And
oh, if only Joe were in Saber's.
You know what? If you voted for Joe in Saber's, Asher would probably be like, yes, that's my favorite ridiculous team or whatever. Something with Joe in it.
Oh, I miss Joe.
Do you have any more spoiler-free thoughts? Or should we dive into the...
Let's talk.
We're in the spoiler section. This is your last warning. If you have not watched Stage Play, go watch it. This is not something that is like super plot. You know, like, it's not like there are like big plot revelations. There is one kind of plot revelation, but more so it's just like, will we taking away the emotional impact of certain things. So if you want to experience those watching the thing for the first time, go do that. Come back to this when you're done watching. And now, Asher, spill your beans.
Joe!
Okay,
Joe.
Okay.
Joe saved Digimon.
Saved Digimon. In so many ways.
In so many ways. Well, why don't we go down the list that you have? I don't agree with this order, but we might as well.
This is the order that they get their Digivolutions in season one.
I mean, this is the traditional order. Yeah. Yes, I know.
Okay, so starting with Taichi.
He's okay.
He's still talking. Like, rah, 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 rah.
He's still better than the regular Tri-Tai.
I mean, I agree.
Yeah, I feel like general theme too, even though lots of great moments, I feel like Taichi's quote-unquote arc and Yamato's quote-unquote arc were the weakest. It, like, so much hinged on them. And it was just like, okay, I mean, I see what you're doing here, but it's not that compelling compared to the other ones.
Compared to the other ones, I look up
to myself, my younger self.
Yeah, I mean, I like the scenario of Taichi acting all confident to, like, as a facade for his younger self, but I feel like there were so many details, and, like, everyone would be like, no, we know. Like, they just kept hitting on that for so long that it was like, maybe he just is that way. Calm down. Like, every time he was excited to do something in Kari, he was like, I don't believe you. It's like, that just, whatever. I mean, it's...
I mean, whatever. I trust Hikari.
I guess so. But I imagine it would be annoying to be in the
same room still.
I hope not.
I don't think they're doing that after O2.
I think they are.
In 0-2, they show them in separate rooms.
Do they?
Yeah, they still have bunk beds, but, like, I don't think they're actually actively sleeping in the same room anymore.
Yeah, I think they show, like, maybe it's just in that, like, Christmas epilogue thing.
That one Christmas episode, yeah.
But the one moment from Taichi I thought was the best moment from Taichi was when he asks Yamato to get his harmonica because he's reminded of their first night in the digital world.
Oh, that's so good.
Like, that was a connection I never made before. And it was like, there were lots of moments in the stage play that made me think, like, whoa, you've thought about this much more than I have, which I feel like Tri doesn't always do. Is often like, I've thought about this much less than you have. Yeah, well, occasionally. Yeah. But
Tri does this thing where, like, they're trying to be cool with their new plot, and that's not what the stage play was about.
Well, they end up just acting like kids who belong at the mall and go to Hot Topic.
And I did like Taichi getting pulled out of his funk by Agumon comparing, because Taichi was like, oh, well, I've, like, regressed or whatever, I've changed, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm frustrated with how much I've changed. And Agumon just mentioning that it's like evolution.
I liked that too.
Yeah.
They could have brought up the bicycle while they were at it, but whatever.
I think the level of callbacks they did was adequate.
I know.
Yeah. Well, lots of great callbacks. I didn't write down anything for Yamato. I said his stuff was a bit over the top.
You like nothing.
You can go ahead.
You just formulated wrong. You like nothing. That's what I
No, I liked everything except that Taichi and Yamato yelled a little bit too much for people who had microphones on. I thought it was actually really fascinating that so much of Matt's problem was related not just to, like, his status as Tai's second in command, but his, and this is going into TK a little bit too, so I'm jumping the gun a little here, but, like, his sense of who he is based on the trauma of his family splitting up. Because his thing was that he wants to stay with everybody. Taichi wants to be strong, but he can't because there are all these other things to consider. And he cannot reconcile his old strength of being brash and reckless with caring so much as he always has, but now he cares in a more, like, aware way. Whereas Matt...
There are consequences.
There are consequences! Crazy!
Consequences?
It's a consequence.
Woke Taichi, 2018.
Woke Taichi.
I wouldn't go that far. But
he's woke enough to realize that if you destroy Odaiba, some people might be inconvenienced.
Yeah, some people might, like, have gotten hurt in that. That's... Right.
Well, actually, that's going too far. Just like that's the thought far. That maybe they have to rebuild, that's where he's at now.
Yeah, he's like, oh, money.
Rebuild and, again.
Yeah, like
Cell phones might be damaged.
Cell phones. Oh, right. Not the cell phones.
Not the bike.
Cell phones still important to the stage play. Just
yes.
Pointing that out.
Lack your...
Whereas Yamato, like, his whole thing, as they spelled it out, is not that he wanted to feel special or chosen anymore. Because remember, one of his earlier, and by earlier, I mean late season one, struggles with Taichi is that, why are you the leader whole deal? But that he just wants to be with everyone. And to be with everyone, he thinks he has to stay the same person, which isn't true. So they both sort of are struggling with the same thing, which makes sense because they're Yamato and Tai and Taichi, and they're two parts of the same Omegamon. But I found it very nice. And I also found that harmonica scene very nice and a really nice jumping point for both of them into their conflicts.
Hmm. I actually can't remember if it's there or a different point, but now I can't remember. I think it was Takaru and Koshiro. Koshiro was trying to like interrupt, but then Takaru had to be like, no, come on, leave them alone, leave them alone. Yeah.
Right before that. Yeah, everyone knew that Taichi and Yamato were dating, and I appreciate that.
There was a line I wrote down, or took a screenshot of, where they were like, what's the line? They're like, Yamato is like, we've been together so long, Taichi. And I'm like, okay, you have been dating.
Oh, that's not the line I was thinking of. There was, even earlier, I think Joe was like, I know it's awkward with Yamato. And I was like, oh, that's an ex-breakup thing if I've ever heard one. Anyway.
Okay, moving on to Sora.
They're dating.
Moving on to Sora. Speaking of dating and not dating anyone.
Right. I feel
Do
like
you I'm have talking- a crush on somebody.
I feel like I'm talking so much, but I have so many feelings about
you. Have
care.
So many feelings. Oh, yeah.
I'll never talk this much again. I actually love that Sora's. Whatever she was struggling with was never really explicitly named and never explicitly resolved. Like, way to go.
True. What was the struggle?
I mean, I feel
like we don't know. We don't know.
The thing I recall is her mentioning that, like, she missed being responsible for everyone else and being the mom. And
she missed the roles. She missed knowing what her role was. She was always the big sister or reminded people of their moms. And now she isn't that. She's just like some girl. Everyone else is changing and she doesn't know how to change because she doesn't know who she was in the first place. Yeah, that's me extrapolating.
I also got the sense that like in season one, when all of her stuff goes down, when she's doubting her crest or whatever, she's like, she had a job. Like she was like, you know, in so much self-doubt or whatever, but she like was going around taking care of everyone. Behind the scenes, and she had a job, and in a lot of ways that was like reflected how her mom treated her, like, you know, like she didn't really show affection very well, but she had a job to take care of or whatever. And
you make it sound like she's like the mafia or something.
I guess so.
I don't know about that. Cool AU.
Sora mafia, Sora yakuza,
yeah.
Taking care of business behind the scenes.
But I think it also fits into one thing she did say was that she, like, when talking about the future, she's just, like, it's completely unable to decide. She's, like, doesn't even know where to start, it seems. And having a purpose, kind of, even though it seemed like she was so, didn't really fit that purpose very well in Adventure or struggle with it or whatever, it was, like, something to do, something that gave her purpose. And now she's, like, I don't have any.
Right. And I think the resolution we can take from that is that it's important to be okay with that. She's only a second year in high school.
Especially, in high school.
I still don't know.
The pressure is really high in Japan. But also, like, you're 16. Chill.
I also, just in the way, all of the teasing about who Sora liked, it just gave me the clear impression the writer has a very, very, very solid idea of what fans want. What they want to hear from Sora. And they were like teasing it, just like putting it like a carrot in front of our mouths and waiting for us to salivate before pulling it away. And
I loved it. I would have been so upset if they like tried to imply one thing or another thing, or even the OT3 that we all know is real. Like, I'm glad it stayed where it was.
Yeah, that's an interesting point though, because I feel like that's something that we've in our reactions to Tribe and frustrated with things staying in the status quo like that, that like their kind of goal of the production is that like things can't really move or drift too much. But I feel like this showed that you can do that and execute it well, whereas Tribe can do it and execute it poorly. And then
Tribe's like has so much more time. It's trying to tell a long story and it's like, oh, but I can't upset the status quo. So like, I'm just telling you nonsense. And you're just like, I don't care.
Like, yeah, it's like a long story where things have changed or moved less. And yeah. Like, and just looking back on Try as like a 3.5-year multimedia project or whatever, like there are so many things that happened in chapter one that we were like, oh, by chapter five, our context will be totally different and things will be so changed now. And it's like, nah.
No.
Still about Mako.
That should have been probably expected. Any more about Sora?
We're rooting for you, Sora.
Sora's the one character where I'll be like, any more about her before moving on? Everyone else will just be like, no, next.
Nope, she's going with Mimi.
So
Sora, I mean, Mimi, I'm okay real with that. OTP.
I mean, yeah.
So Koshiro. Slash Izzy.
Whatever you want to call him. Koshiro.
I never really noticed that it's that we have Joe and Ko.
Oh, believe me, we noticed. It's all over the ship names.
Well, that's true.
Joko.
I actually, Kojo. There was something, I listened to a podcast recently that was, I think the premise was basically people who didn't really have much familiarity with Digimon, and they watched it when they were kids, but they went and revisited it, and their reactions were not, watching like a couple episodes, random episodes of Adventure, and their impressions were not, they were like, this show was terrible, it was garbage, whatever. And one of the things they criticized it for was that, like,
They're not wrong.
they're not totally wrong, but there's a lot that you appreciate better if you actually go in liking it and not going in hating it. I think there are a lot of things you write off as being stupid that if you go in with an appreciation, you understand that they're not just stupid. But one of those things they said were just stupid was that like the makeup of the seven kids, because I don't think they've even gotten to Hikari yet, that the makeup of the seven kids was like, why are there two nerds? Like Joe and Izzy are redundant. And I feel like
Okay, right.
That's, but I feel like this stage play, like there's a scene in here that does like explains that to a T. It's the point where I guess Koshiro has explained his theory and then says that he like would rate it at about a B, his like confidence in the theory.
That was my favorite.
And Joe is like kind of like, oh, so a B is like a good grade, and Koshiro's like, B is not a good grade, and then Joe just like goes to attack Koshiro.
I thought we were doing ridiculous dialogue drafts, so I wrote down a bunch of stuff. No, I realize that now because it's not on the thing. But he said, gotcha. All right. It was at an hour and a half in. And Joe says, Koshiro, if you could grade your explanation based on how confident you are with it, what would it be? Koshiro's like, huh? Well, I guess a barely passing B grade. Joe says, I see. Then go tell Taichi and the others about it right now. Koshiro's like, but. And then Joe says, don't tell me that a B grade doesn't make you confident. And Koshiro just gets this huge smile on his face, like, actually, it doesn't. And Joe tried to kill him.
Because, yeah, I mean, I think it is actually something that Try has in the other Try movies, and this has added a layer to Joe's characterization that in retrospect makes so much sense. And I think it never really clicked in the original until they added this layer that like Joe is not a great student or like not a genius. He struggles to get B's. And compared to Izzy or Koshiro, who is a natural genius, doesn't really have to try. And those are like an important difference in quote unquote nerds or geeks or whatever.
I mean, but they're also just such different, like what Koshiro cares about. Like it's a classic difference in nerddom. Like what Koshiro cares about is just doing what he wants to do and gathering that knowledge in the moment and just like making whatever cool computer stuff. And Joe is like, I want to rigorously fit into this system and do well at this school system thing that we have already set in place. Like we Joe see wants Koshiro to be a just good, gets out of that.
Yeah. Joe wants to be a good boy.
Yeah.
Koshiro just wants to know everything about everything.
And yeah.
Okay, wait. So this is supposed to be about Koshiro. We're letting Joe take over the show.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, because Joe is the better nerd in this thing.
He always has been. Joe has always been the best not true. Boy. Yes, he has.
Okay.
So I feel like Koshiro didn't have like tons of great moments. He had lots of like exposition and stuff. He was a key to the plot and had funny lines. But the moment that like stood out to me as like a great character beat, I think he really only had the one where he was talking about how they're talking about the future sitting on the camp. And he says that he doesn't like, he's like, sure, I could do stuff with computers, but like, I'm not really decided yet. And I don't think the stage play really sold that as like a huge moment in and of itself, but that was something that I've like observed people who like, I basically have a friend who in college like was very Kosher-esque. I basically met him freshman year of college, and he like, I was basically studying computer science from scratch at that point. And this person, my friend, had like come in with like tons of knowledge, like already had done tons of computer science stuff, like knew a ton of stuff, was definitely not a beginner, but he came in, it was a liberal arts college. So he was like, yeah, I'm great at computers, but like, I want to do something else. And I don't want to like just do computers. And then he ended up doing computer stuff. He ended up becoming an engineer anyway. But like, because of learning, you know, seeing other things and eventually deciding. So I feel like in the outline of what they had to work with here, that like Koshiro, super into computers as a kid, Koshiro in the epilogue, super into computers, like there is still a struggle to get between those two points. It's not like a surefire, obvious, like, oh, he did start there, he ended there, of course. Like there's still, yeah.
It was hard for me to buy based on the rest of Try, though, where we see that like he's doing his own thing.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have any doubt there. He seems to be like,
yeah.
Yeah, he seems like he has connections with like an American corporation and like, has an office space. Like, yeah, it doesn't really fit into that. But you can just ignore. Just like,
I can't buy this at all. No, I can't ignore Try as much as I want to.
I was ignoring Try. I consider it like two different timelines. And then when they tried to bridge it at the end, I was like, wait, what are you doing? Why are you crossing the streams?
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, there's no way to reconcile stuff at the end that fits in any kind of timeline anyway. So
yeah, my defining moment for Koshiro was not that. And I think this plays to, I think the differences in what interests me and what interests you, Jeff, about Koshiro is that his moment was when he was talking to Ty during Ty's climactic moment. And he was like, haven't I been watching you this entire time? Because I think a thing that gets overlooked a lot with Koshiro is that in a lot of ways, if Matt is Ty's foil, Koshiro is Ty's backup. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
He's not the Robin to Ty's Batman. That doesn't make any sense. But he's like, have you guys watched Kim Possible?
Mm-mm.
What?
Actually,
not
have you?
Enough.
Okay. Well, there's a guy in the chair, basically. And I know some of you have watched Spider-Man. there's support, and Joe is to Yamato. So I keep because now I'm thinking about Adventure, which I have mostly watched dubbed, so now the names are getting all confused. Joe is to Yamato what Koshiro is to Tai Chi, and I thought that was really. I thought they could have done. I loved that it happened, and I did want to see more like internal stuff with Koshiro, but like I want to see him like step into that role more and support people. I think there's been a trend as time has gone on since 02, I guess, where Koshiro's just gotten somehow more stereotypical, awkward, socially, what's the word? Missing cues.
Me?
Yeah. Yeah, that word.
No, or diving more into his like awkward crush with Mimi in Try. And
I thought that this did a better job of selling them as a couple than Try,
I love
the beginning of this.
Get into Mimi. So I think there's been a trend of Koshiro getting more socially inept, which I think is kind of weird. Like not unheard of, but not what I would expect in a show about growing up. I want to see him do more of that support stuff because he's really actually very good at that. Anyway,
I have one nit to pick, which is when he's talking about the first of all, the whole thing where he like figures out something's wrong because he like calculates the likelihood. Actually, he doesn't figure. He like suspects something's up when he like does the likelihood of the campgrounds being empty. That was a great moment, but his math was wrong. I wanted to point that out there.
Because Jeff is really the ultimate nerd here.
As the Koshiro of this podcast. It's not that his math. It's not that his math, I mean, his math about like actually calculating the probability of the campgrounds is like unverifiable. It's random BS. But he says that it's like the number he gives is basically 0 point and then four zeros and then 3%. Yes. And that is, he says that's the same probability as throwing a die 8 times and getting the same number. But that's actually 10 times off that if you do the math. It's 3 zeros, not 4 zeros. So just...
Jeff, they're children.
And also,
people who don't know math.
He did the calculation without any kind of computers or calculators or anything. So
he did the calculation in the dirt. So
that's fine.
Actually, no, he did the calculation for the campground thing. He mentioned the dice roll thing just off the top of his head. So
yeah, so it's fine that he's wrong. See,
yeah,
he's in the ballpark.
he was under a lot of stress
again.
I just wanted to one up him a little bit here. So
wow,
he noticed.
Yeah.
Wait, now Jeff. I have a question. If Jeff is the Koshiro, who are the rest of us?
Uh-oh.
I'm the younger brother.
Oh, yeah. I guess Andrew's TK.
Do I have to be a girl?
I'm not good at it. You don't have to be.
You have three choices, actually. You can be... You can be tomboy, girly girl, or Jesus. That's all you can be.
I mean, I would be tomboy, so... I'm not Jesus.
You could be Rika. How about that?
Yeah, can I be Rika?
We don't have to stick to season one.
Yeah.
but I still don't know who I am, which is why I'm
Ash. You're Asher.
Ash isn't Pokemon.
I wasn't talking about that, Ash. I'm talking about you're you.
No, I want to be a Digimon character.
Okay, think about it really hard. Obviously, I Ryo.
I was like, for a second, I was like, maybe Joe. But then I was like, Joe, but without any of his, like, not any, without all of his, like, huge burden of responsibility.
Yeah. If Ash was anyone in the Joe family, I would be Joe.
That's true. I'd be one of the elder brothers.
There you go.
Which is the one that gets a Digimon? I get them confused because in the dub, they're the same person.
Does it even matter anymore?
I assume they both do by the end of the epilogue.
I mean, yeah, by the end of the epilogue, but there's a drama CD that takes place.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes.
Okay. Moving on to Mimi.
Yeah.
It's like she jumped up from the TV screen and ended up in real life.
I know. Her actress is spot on.
She's Mimi. She's like literally Mimi.
Well, actually, she's very literally try Mimi, which I found like, oh, like, because she does change from season to season. And like, that was definitely Digimon try Mimi.
I feel like try Mimi is like more anime tropey, if that makes any sense.
How so?
More anime tropey than season one Mimi?
Or season two Mimi?
Because season one Mimi reminded me more of like American Valley Girl. I mean, that's because of the dub. That's what it played out. But like...
Yeah.
But whereas try Mimi seems like a more like stereotypical like girl, like Haruhi Suzumiya type kind of almost...
No. Haruhi never listens to anyone.
I was thinking neither Genki Girl without saying Genki Girl.
Yeah, neither does Mimi.
And yeah, I'm thinking like the way that Haruhi treats whatever that the time travel girl. And Mikuru? Like yeah, and like is like kind of how she treats Mako and like just like the Genki Girl. Like I think it's more rooted in the Genki Girl stereotype. I didn't want to say Genki Girl because I don't know the full details of that trope, but something about it just feels more like, not that it's bad, I just think that like it feels more like an established thing.
I think, and I don't think you're wrong. And I think she, I mean, okay, it's one thing to assume that the show creators are doing that, which I think they are, but I think that could also be Mimi herself playing into that because she's trying to be a certain kind of acceptable Japanese girl when, like, having come back to Japan, when, like, her experiences are all over the place. So, like, yes, and I think that's cool.
A quick note, like, in regards to her coming back to Japan, at first, when Hikari, like, says something to the effect of, like, assuming that Mimi had things figured out in the future because she went to America, at first I was like, that makes no sense. But then I thought about it more, I'm like, that is the kind of not making sense that I feel like kids would think, would be like, you're like a big shot, you went to America, you must have all things all figured out. And it's like,
No. I assumed that Hikari made that comment because, Mimi went to America because there was something specific she wanted to do and learn in America, is what I got out of that.
That's I think where I was going too, but I feel like it's the kind of logical, like, I feel like what our like logic is like, of course she she couldn't choose to go to America because of studying something she wanted to do. Like, of course she went there because of her family. And I feel like that's something that, like, Hikari could have figured out too, but is the kind of logical disconnect or not thinking something through thoroughly that people do.
I don't know. I feel like that happens more often among non-Americans.
So can we talk about how different Mimi is wanting to go on this trip?
Right? She grew up so much. She wanted to be a caveman.
I was like off put by that initially. I was like, I don't feel like I understand why Mimi. As it went on, I was like, okay, I see now. But like,
but
as
6 years ago,
in the opening, I was just like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I didn't make the connection to how different it is from her being afraid of. And there's like a brief glimmer of that when she's like annoyed with the bugs itching or something.
Right.
But yeah, it is pretty different. And it is nice. I feel like it also is grounded. It makes sense because it's like this. That's another aspect I really like of the setting up of the scenario, that like it's this campground where they're in the wilderness, but also like there's a kombini right next door. There is a train. Like it's all they keep establishing how safe and secure it is, so that when they pull the rug out from under them, it actually like feels earned.
Right.
And yeah, I feel like it makes sense that she would be so gung-ho about this like pseudo camping when like it is really easy for her to just retreat if she needed to.
And also like I don't think we should discount that she grew a ton over season one. And of why wouldn't she want to feel that accomplishment again?
Yeah, like, also it is what they do.
When we think, in season two, she's all for traveling.
And they like that's how they meet with her when she visits, is they go on a picnic to the digital world.
Right.
So,
Right. Yeah.
Although I guess that's the whole thing. It's a picnic and it's not a, you know, scavenging adventure kind of thing.
But still a picnic in the digital world where it is like known to be dangerous. And then she like isn't afraid of anything.
Yeah.
Mimi's fearless for season one.
I like how I guess she's putting on a brave face like most, like everyone else. But the thing that she's hung up on is that she has so many things she wants to do. I found that really relatable and fits her character.
Yeah.
She brought up the one she does become though first.
Yeah. I thought that was, I can't remember the order, but the fact that she's like, I want to do these like 50 things, but right now I'm into this thing, which happens to also be exactly what I end up doing in my career. Wink, wink, was a little bit.
Just don't let her cope with the bananas that are growing everywhere.
But I think it does maybe have to tie, because that is a plot point of Try Chapter 4 as well, that she makes the jelly bean stuff, right? The jelly bean something or other. Or she comes up with the experimental cooking. I think Sora made them, but like it was Mimi's recipe or something.
Right.
So that fits the experimental.
I have no recollection of this.
I was thinking of the candies that she has in the first one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, but yeah, she definitely has some pastry thing in four.
Some pastry with jelly beans on it.
I loved that her secret was that she didn't have a crush on anyone. Yeah. A master stroke.
That was great.
Or Joe and Koshiro.
Joe has a girlfriend.
Joe does not have a girlfriend.
She was not mentioned in this.
Or it didn't happen. Yeah, she was not mentioned in this. That's true.
Are you the real Joe?
That would have been a good... imagine if they, like, Koshiro to test if it was real Joe is like, Joe, do you have a girlfriend?
And Joe's like, yes. And they're like, he's not the real Joe.
It's a lie.
Yeah, Mimi.
Mimi.
Should we move on to Joe?
I still love her. Moving on to Joe.
Okay.
Wait, we didn't do Joe already?
I mean,
we did Coach. We
brought up Joe in regards to everyone else.
We just like hijacked everybody with Joe.
Okay, in broad strokes, I like how Joe, being the only one who has his shit together in this stage play, is like a nice inversion of chapter 1 and 2, where he's the only one who doesn't have his shit together at all.
I love Joe Kido.
It's not that he has his shit together. It's that he knows what he wants, and he's trying to get it together.
Right.
Exactly. He is the opposite of having his shit together.
Yeah, because it's definitely not together. Let's be clear here.
Right, he just has a goal.
He has a goal that he's working towards instead of everybody else's trying to like work towards some regressive goal.
Yeah. I also just love how he is so excited and then later depressed about getting a B on a practice test. Like,
yep.
Practice test. Oh, that's real. If you've never like been around, like if you maybe you haven't had that experience because we all are like fancy smart people, but like if you've ever been around people who have had that experience, like,
yeah, Ash,
look, I've been around those people, all right?
Yeah, so have I, and it's you.
It is, yeah. No, I am not. I am the in that does a bee fill you with confidence? Like in that
Ash would be like, this sucks. Show, I failed.
Yeah, yeah, like. Yeah. No, I am not the one who's excited about a B on a mock exam. I remember mock exams. Nevermore.
Nevermore.
Well, I think it's like being excited about the B in the mock exam is like one thing. Being frustrated that you didn't actually get the B in the mock, like that many layers removed is enough to be like, okay, that's great. That's fantastic.
That's real.
He's like, I thought I had this great achievement of getting a B in a practice test. I don't even have that.
No, that stress was real. I felt so bad. you dream that you did something and then you have to do it again.
Right. And it's like his bar is so low for that dream.
Right. Was Andrew just asked, where did Joe go?
Where did he actually go in that time then?
He was still in the dream or in the digital world. He took the test there.
Yeah.
But he wasn't in that fragment where they were trapped, is what happened.
Yeah, that seemed a little bit stretchy. Like it was like, oh, he isn't trapped. Oh wait, they've all been trapped. Oh wait, so I guess he was trapped. Oh,
No. Yeah. Not trapped as hard.
Not trapped in the same way.
Care about the plot.
Yeah.
They cared about giving us what we wanted, which they did.
It was all just a nice callback to Joe being off doing something on his own, being more interested in test taking than adventures. They found a way to tie that into it well without being about writing him out of the plot.
He was the key to the plot. Yo.
I really liked his passing reference. I guess it's when Yamato is talking about like being friends with people because they're chosen or because he wants to be friends with them or whatever. And like Joe makes the passing distinction that like the distinction between him in adventure wanting to be a doctor because his parents wanted him to and wanting to be a doctor because he chose to. And that's something that I feel like the narrative of adventure itself never pointed out how similar those things seem and never elaborated. And it didn't really elaborate on how different they are, but just like his passing acknowledgement that they are different was enough to make me be like, okay, good. That's a thing. Anyway. I also really like that, like, it sounds like the rest of his family are Koshiros. Like, they're all, like, somewhat naturally gifted, and he's the one who has to struggle to become a doctor, and, like, that fits so much more that, like, there is angst to his choosing to be a doctor. That it's one thing for his family to say, like, you must become a doctor, but if he then turns around and says, I want to be a doctor, they'll be like, psh, you become a doctor? Kind of has the worst of both worlds in a compelling way.
What? I'm not sure his family was ever pressuring him to be a doctor. I think he just got the idea that he was supposed to because his dad and both his brothers were.
Mm, that's probably true. I think I calculated too much.
Wait, didn't his oldest brother not become a doctor, though?
Yeah. I think he did, but then he went off to, like, Africa or something.
Because he was with Sora's father.
He was a medical doctor of history. Exactly. It doesn't make sense.
He got a doctorate?
I think if I had to guess without doing the research right now, it would be that he had one brother who was a doctor and a dad who was a doctor, and the dub merged the two brothers into one quasi-doctor, quasi-historian.
Cool.
That is pretty cool. That's a cool major.
That's a really complicated school...
Well, history doesn't have too many requirements, actually. You could do it.
Yeah, but then you have to go to medical school.
Any last call for Joe?
Yes.
Joe moments?
I loved when Joe went into the audience and had a scene. That was fun. I think I generally just, like...
Oh, that's where he went. He went to the audience.
Yeah, he went to the audience. That's where he was the whole time.
He was just watching in the audience.
I wonder if he was taking his test in the audience.
That would be funny.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I doubt it, because I think the audience would bother him if he did, but that would be genius.
We can imagine. It was off screen, so we can pretend it happened.
Yes. Yeah. Fan fiction.
Of dry stage play.
No, not even like fan fiction of the events of the stage play. Fan fiction of the production of the stage play.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I love it. That's exactly the level of meta I want.
I also feel like Joe just had the proper balance throughout of like, Joe is always a joke, but kind of taking things too seriously. But for once I was like, I feel the balance of this in this hokey play. Like, yeah. I appreciate this scene where Gomamon and Joe are like, let's go fishing. And then Gomamon's like, do you know how to fish? And Joe's like, why can't you actually just do the fishing?
Why can't Gomamon do it? Come on.
Because they're his friends.
Do you want
to? They don't want to eat.
Ash, the fish are his friends.
That's true. Yeah,
that is true. They are his friends.
Yeah,
but doesn't he actually do that at one point in adventure?
Yeah, I think that is a thing.
So.
They're his friends that he likes to eat because he's into that.
He's just friends with benefits.
No. Wrong on many
it's
levels.
It's like the Lion King all over again.
Okay, to distract from that, I'm going to mention something that's a detail about Joe that probably should have been a little bit obvious, but I never realized. And it's that his, the thing that I always think of Japanese word that reminds me of Joe is that the word for joke is jodan. So whenever I learned that word for jodan and try to remember it, I'm like, oh, it's joke don. It's Joe. He's a joke. Jodan.
That's so mean.
It is a little mean. But what I didn't realize until reading, looking at the cast list in Japanese and seeing the kanji that's actually used for his name, but it's the kanji that means like sturdy. I'm like, that fits almost too well.
Reliable Joe.
Sturdy Joe.
Sturdy Joe.
Okay, wait. Since we used Koshiro's time to hijack it with Joe a little
I do have to correct myself. Apparently, it's not actually sturdy. That's it's length, height, stature.
So two different ways to describe a penis.
What?
Okay, Ashley, what were we gonna say?
What was I gonna say? I forgot to mention Koshiro's sick line of talking to Tai Chi, and he's like, "You're the closest one to a caveman among us, Tai Chi." And I'm like, "Yes, Koshiro."
Yeah, that would have been one of my RDD picks.
I love you, Koshiro. Good times.
Maybe Jeff Nimoy, his like one of his like passions is like a caveman diet blog.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe he'd be into this.
Oh yeah.
Anyway,
to tweet him.
Takaru.
He existed.
Yeah,
I kind of struggled when I kind of made this outline. I was like, I can't really recall any highlighted moment, but I did remember one. And it's when they're talking about the futures early on, and he describes like the idea of following his passion as being difficult because of what he's observed of his parents. And I was like,
yeah.
Oh, first of all, like Tri like has like not really acknowledged the existence of parents except for tiny little glimpses. And to like acknowledge the existence of them in a way that like makes so much sense. We've seen Yamato and Takaru's dad be exhausted from overwork because of his passion for his reporter job, whatever it is. We haven't really seen his mom, but like it makes sense that she would be, you know, that life as a writer or whatever would be stressful and stuff. And like,
I would, like on top that, of raising a kid on her own.
Yeah, yeah. So that was another element where I was like, whoa, you have thought about this much more than I have. And that is rare for Tri.
Yeah, well, I meant it dovetailed nicely because then he goes specifically into his mom about writing. And I was like, well, if Takaru is supposed to be a writer, like, you seeded it, you did it, stage play.
Yeah,
you did this better than anything.
Excuse me, Ashley, in Tri Chapter 1, he had a blog and something.
He did.
The Digi-Destiny of the world.
Yeah, the Digi-Destiny of the world. True.
Digi-Destined to disappear.
Who have not been mentioned
since. I still feel like
since.
This moment did a better job than...
Yeah, no.
Blog where Digi-Destined is misspelled.
His hat was still bad.
It's true.
I feel like he was maybe the one actor who I felt like I at times had to remind myself that he was Takaru, but it helped that he had the hat occasionally. To be like, all right, he's the one with the hat. Okay.
He had a hat in the second half and you were good.
Right, exactly. That is his defining feature.
Yeah.
There was a moment when Edamon has a hat. I was like, Takaru, what are you doing in a monkey suit? No.
Blur. Never mind. I was going to say something about Takaru and separation anxiety and his parents, but I didn't actually come up that much.
Yeah, it came up more in Matt.
Yeah, I think it was subtler in Matt and also better in Matt.
Mm. Matt worked better.
I want to know who ended up with that pink...
sleeping bag.
Oh, yeah. Pink sleeping bag, Takaru's highlight moment, buying it for Yamato.
It was good.
And so now, last but least, Hikari.
What? Hey! Hey!
I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it entirely.
Did you not?
It was 50% joke, 50% maybe some truth.
Ouch. I thought she did very well.
She did very well for Hikari on a scale of Hikari.
I really appreciated the girls scene in their tent.
Mm. Yes.
Like, yes, it was super stereotypical, but we got to see sides of all of them that we have never seen ever.
I just like that Mimi wore her sleeping bag like over her head that whole time.
That was a great like stage production to like have her walking around in the
sleeping bag. Like, and Hikari did too.
Yeah.
It wasn't over her, like Mimi had it on as like a hood.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Mimi was doing it hardcore. Hikari was just following along.
Other great moments in that were like Hikari telling the horror story of the Dark Ocean episode.
Yes, yeah, so I was like, wait a second.
That was fantastic.
I don't know if Mimi realized she was actually telling a true story.
I'm like, does Mimi know that this happened? Oh, crap.
Yeah,
like,
maybe I didn't have a question.
Hikari taking this like hugely traumatic thing that happened to her and turning it into a joke. Like, look at her overcoming that.
I was almost taken to be bride.
It was a scary story.
Yeah.
It was a scary story to scare Mimi, which makes it a joke.
Mm. But apparently, Edamon went to the Dark Ocean. All right, we'll get to that.
Yeah. Whoa.
I mean, I feel like
maybe the ocean.
I feel like maybe that was just like a unification of ideas of whatever. I think they call it the Dark Network in the Venture, where he is when he like evolves into Metal Edamon after getting sucked in with Datamon or whatever.
That was the Dark Network, yes. Well, Dark Network was, I think, actually the name of one of his attacks.
Right. Yeah, I guess I forget what he calls it then. Like, I don't know. It just makes sense to like unify those two concepts of like the place where the void where he existed and became Metal Edamon. And I don't know how much that means for the deeper lore. But
the deeper lore is now tragically even more messed up than it was.
There's more fuel around the Dark Ocean. Like, how can you say no to more mystery around the Dark Ocean?
I feel like it's not like it's more fuel in a way that like complicates the lore or anything. I feel like this is just like the most straightforward and natural. It's kind of in that way. Yeah. It feels a bit like fan fiction, and then it's like exactly what we've been speculating and expecting for a while.
That is true, actually.
Not in a bad way, right? But that like
right fan fiction is a good thing.
So things about Hikari. One moment that really surprised me that like wasn't really emphasized a ton, but Hikari talking about wanting to be a kindergarten teacher, which first of all, it's weird. I think it's weird. Maybe it's normal, but I think it's weird to be like in middle school and be like, my goal is to be a kindergarten teacher. That's exactly what I want to do. And I'm like, what? That's very specific. But I understand that like if you want to be, sometimes people want to be a teacher and they're like, I want to teach young kids. I don't want to teach high schoolers, which she probably wouldn't know because she hasn't even been a high schooler yet. So.
She sees her brother.
She's seen a lot of high schoolers.
Ooh,
I
would
want to teach him either.
She's been in the onsen. She has definitely seen a lot of high schoolers.
Oh God,
dude, she's
that's her brother. That's her brother. Oh God.
That's not what I wanted.
But anyway, the through line from when she's talking about being a coming kindergarten teacher and if she can like do that job or whatever, and Tailmon mentions that like, will you raise me? And I'm like, Tailmon or Gatomon or whatever, like, I feel like Adventure really didn't do a great job of showing that, of showing like Hikari nurturing Tailmon to becoming good or whatever, or changing her ways, but taking that as a given, like connecting that to her becoming a teacher, I thought was really interesting and thoughtful.
Also, going back to the kindergarten thing, I'm wondering if the school system in Japan is a little different and there might be a separate like kindergarten thing the way we have preschool.
Right.
Because I'm thinking of uniforms and like there's an image I have of Japanese kindergarten that I think is different from Japanese elementary school. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but like that might be the weirdness that's preschool, I'm pretty sure, Andrew. But like that might be the weirdness we're tapping on here. I don't know. I didn't go. I'm the only one here who hasn't been to Japan.
The thing that's weird to me, I just looked up the Japanese word for kindergarten, and there must be some kind of common root. I mean, I guess our word for kindergarten is from German. Maybe there's this similarly, because it's like the kanji involve garden. It's like image. It's like youth immature garden is the word for kindergarten. I'm like, huh.
Now that I think about it, I don't remember any kindergarten in anything.
What?
Look, I don't know, man.
Is this like Kingdom Hearts, the beginning of Kingdom Hearts 2, where they like forget the word picture? Like, I've never heard of kindergarten. What's a kindergarten?
No, in like any Japanese media, I think of preschool, and then they just start going to elementary.
I haven't really seen like preschool either.
Yeah, they must have like a different concept.
Yeah, looking through like sentence examples on gshow.org's sentence repository, which is not a great repository of sentences, apparently is somewhat user submitted, so it's with a grain of salt, but like it seems like the word that is translated as kindergarten here, which maybe is a different word they use in the actual stage play, I haven't looked that up, cross-referenced, but the general word that means kindergarten, number one definition, seems like can also mean like nursery school or preschool, so
okay,
anyway yeah. And I think that the thing she mentions as a struggle is being like, she wants to become a kindergarten teacher, but doesn't know if she'll actually enjoy that or if she just thinks it's like a good like thing that she looks up to. On the one hand, I like that, but I also think that's way too realistic of her to be thinking of at that stage in her life. Like,
Hikari has always been a very serious child.
Yeah, I guess it's more of her like her Jesus instincts that she's like thinking like well, I think 30 years ahead.
It's that, and she has like this reckless older brother. So like as he's doing his struggle, I think she internalizes some of that as well. Because he doesn't know what he's doing, and she's like, oh God, I have to help, but I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that, like, at least in our generation, people don't realize until they're on the job that they, like, I definitely had a goal of, like, a specific company in mind. This is a lesser degree. It's not about the job in particular, but, like, I had a specific company in mind, and I didn't realize that I didn't actually like that working at that company because I held it up as, like, this ideal. And I feel like it's weird for Hikari to be, like, 20 years removed from that, be, like, or 10 years, whatever, removed from that, be, like, maybe that's not the, like, she's way too prescient. She's way too
smart. She has a lot of older friends. I think actually what sold me on this stage play was a Hikari moment very early on where she was calling Taichi in. He's the one that's hardest for me to remember. She was calling Taichi in, and she was like, I'm not this little girl that's gonna wait for you anymore. And he was like, what's wrong? And then they just had this cute moment. And I was like, oh, this is what I've been missing from my life for 20 years.
Siblings.
Okay. Aww. So now that we've talked about the chosen children, I think we should move on to one of the biggest parts of the stage play. And a very, very much a mixed bag, Edamon. Yeah.
Oh, Edamon.
I want to start off. He was so uncomfortable. Yeah, I want to start off with the positives, I guess, that, like, I think the idea of Edamon, first of all, he's generally a fun villain, right? And I think the idea of him wanting to hang out, like, this whole, like, perpetual summer, perpetual August 1st, being tied to Edamon, also just wanting to, like, hang out with the kids forever, is great, A+, but, yeah, the uncomfortableness, the predatory gay stereotypes.
Yeah, love it. Yeah,
tail is so hard.
God.
Yeah. Like at first, I was like, "Oh, haha! I find this funny." Like it is kind of like in the same way that like, "Oh, there's shipping subtext." I find this funny. This is kind of gay. Haha, funny. But then it became a point of like, this is what everyone else finds so uncomfortable, and it's vilified for that, and it becomes more and more over the top and part of the villainy, and not just the villainy, but the like, you know, like everyone is uncomfortable about it, and. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that is not good. And I do want to kind of explain, because there is a word that's thrown around, because he calls himself, when he digivolves into King Edamon, he calls himself King of Kings, and then he says, like, I don't know, King of Okamas or whatever. And
something like that.
Yeah, and I tried to like research more about Okama culture to get a good footing on this. And it doesn't, like, because the problem is that I don't think Okama culture means a specific one thing. I think it is, it can range from being a hugely derogative slur that is like synonymous with gay, with I guess gay men particularly.
Yes.
Or it can be a thing that's been reclaimed by gay culture, by homosexuals in Japan, to be a positive thing. And I think the thing that I can't, the thing that I think seems the most pertinent to this discussion and this stage play is that gay representation, not even just in the media, but like in culture in Japan, often conflates gayness with cross-dressing, and in a way that I think like we in America have a lot more axes of expression that are open to people. So I don't know.
Well,
that,
I mean, it depends on your circle.
Oh yeah, totally. So I just feel like that's kind of why like this word that is in some ways a synonym for, like, if you look up Okama, like the first result you get is the Wikipedia article, which just redirects homosexuality in Japan. And I'm like, well, this isn't just homosexuality, but like,
yeah,
it seems
it's,
like
it's a particular presentation of an identity that combines performed homosexuality with a specific performed femininity.
Yeah.
In a way that is meant to be over the top, often treated as a joke, derided. It has been used, I don't know. Speaking purely from the standpoint of someone of you know, a transgender guy who's watched a lot of anime, the presentations of Okama vary hugely, but are generally not positive.
Yeah.
At best, they're like neutral.
Mm-hmm. And
this one is definitely not positive.
Oh, no. The other two major ones, well, three major ones, if you want sort of like a spectrum. if you want a very problematic but sort of uplifting but still really problematic image, go to One Piece,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure Jeff can back me up on. Tokyo Godfathers is really good for this.
Okay, the one caveat, I haven't watched Tokyo Godfathers yet. Ashley and I keep meaning to make Ashley watch it with me. But what I've heard from listening,
I think they removed it.
What?
They removed it from Amazon, I think.
Oh, really? As of like the past week?
Yeah. During the Purge. Anyway,
well, I have a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But
what
I've heard from listening to the Anime Feminist podcast, they did an episode on Tokyo Godfathers recently, and apparently the subtitles using the official version are very non-neutral in how it treats transgender characters and misgenders them. Yeah. Yeah. And like, I think uses like particularly like word. I forget. I think they like refer to characters with offensive. I think like the word auntie is thrown around. I forget the context, but it's thrown in one way.
I mean, misgender. That I feel, because I feel like there are characters in Tokyo Godfather that would use that language. So like, and there is like an idea of reclamation. Like I would understand it like from an Okama to another Okama.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I don't know though how these subtitles treated. I have not seen Tokyo Godfathers in a long time. Also, is my other caveat. I don't know if it's as positive as I'm remembering it, because it was like my first exposure to like, oh my god, a positive representation of this. And then the other thing,
mostly positive.
Yes, I remember
except
that.
Except when
much.
It's not like,
right. The other thing is Ouran High School Host Club, where it's very subtle and understated. And
wait,
all
which one of them is Okama?
The father.
Haruhi's dad.
Oh wow, I definitely don't remember him.
Yeah. Haruhi's dad, and then like he has some friends.
I kind of
it's like really, really low key. And like you get the idea that there are different levels of like being part of this of being part of this lifestyle, yeah.
What about Kurugahime or Jellyfish Princess?
But Kurunosuke doesn't identify that way.
True.
Even in the only one I can really speak to is One Piece, and even in the world of One Piece, there are several different characters that it's
different levels of problematic.
Right, it's such a mix of like uplifting and hugely problematic. There's One Piece. There's an entire like country of Okama that is
Oh god, that was
Yes.
So, okay. That is just to mean anything in some ways. But like there are stereotypes that poke fun, mean fun at Okamas and Okama like presenting people. But they are also still like good people. So yeah, it's mixed bag.
And I know that like in One Piece, like the way it intersects with reality, there is positive intent behind some of it. Like there is a the voice, so one of the prominent characters is named Ivankov, and the voice actor for that character is someone who is an Okama in real life that the author of One Piece was a big fan of. And so like it's clearly not meant, like it's clearly in some ways meant to be positive, but in the ways in which other things are represented positively, quote unquote trying to be positively, it is super not just like capital problematic, but like hurtful, offensive, you know, reinforcing stereotypes that lead to real bodily harm and murder and like anyway
that's
kind of like the subtext or the context of finding all of Edamon's like, oh haha, so funny, he's hitting on the kids, hitting on like I like that he is like so frustrated with losing to Taichi that one battle, even though he came back later, like that's the one thing that's on his mind, that he wants to get revenge and wants to set up the scenario where he can face off against Taichi and Agumon, but that it's also wrapped in like, and I want to kiss you, it's like and okay, I don't want to kiss you, fine, I don't want to kiss you with this predatory gay stereotype Okama all
not fun.
Nah, there was a funny I mean it's not funny in light of all this frustration, but like there's in one of the big clips of, in the behind the scenes footage on the second DVD, I think it's Taichi, maybe it's a different character, I think it's Taichi who's just like walking off stage and just being like, I was kissed. And I was like, okay, I didn't really understand what he was saying at first, and I was like, oh, I get it now. And anyway, oh, so okay, one thing going back to the positives of Edamon, when he's listing off the, and there are lots of positives, like it is generally funny, like the Edamon 5, whatever they're called, is like a funny, it's a fun moment. And I don't know, but also when he's listing
moment the, where they're making fun of Tokusatsu.
Oh yeah, like yeah. I was like, oh, these are totally, it's Power Ranger Edamons.
Oh yeah, right, definitely.
But they make cries like when they cry out that scream. That's what that's like something from Kamen Rider.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
luckily they don't have a hand gesture, so that could have been so much worse.
But the moment I found, I think it was like the moment that I laughed the most in the stage play was when Edamon, this moment, is like listing the like vices, not the vices of society, but the like things that are wrong with the world, and like global warming and things like that. Yeah. And he lists PPAP as one of them. That is something that might go over.
Pineapple.
Yeah, pineapple.
Apple guy.
Pineapple pen.
It's what PPAP.
You don't know pineapple pen.
It's a comedian. It's what?
Hold on.
Come on.
Hold on. We're taking a break.
I would think that Edamon would love this guy, though.
Yeah, it actually, right? I mean, he's just like frustrated.
He just
like,
is Edamon.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh,
There's also a version with Ryuk from Death Note. This was a thing in apparently around November of 2016, I guess. It was a huge, I think it was like the number one song in Japan iTunes and stuff.
Seriously?
Japan!
I think I've like seen the memes based on this, but I have not actually seen the original. All right. I don't want to watch Ryuk do this.
It's fantastic. I don't know who like animated this. It's like a really advanced CGI model of Ryuk. Very articulate. Lots of motion.
I mean, a lot of people, what they have, they just do this. They get the models and just do it.
Hmm.
I mean, somebody does the models, but like once the models are made. Yeah.
Okay. So back from our PPAP adventure. That was a good joke. That was my point.
Ooh,
that was my
point. And Edamon is jealous of,
Edamon's jealous of whatever this guy's name is. I forget. I think he actually is like a famous comedian now, mainly because of PPAP, but I forget his name. Picataro, maybe? I don't know.
No, he's been famous way before this.
Oh, yeah. I guess.
At least in Japan.
But not like as this was like huge.
This is a global phenomenon.
So, okay, I guess we, in passing, mentioned how the canonicity of this movie is bizarre, but I guess there isn't much to add to that, because, it's just bizarre. It doesn't... If you plot out the timeline of Adventure, it has to take place in the middle of Chapter 3, because Chapter 2 has a school festival, which happens while they're still in school, and the Japanese school year ends around July, and the Chapter 3 picks up right after school festival that same day, and then ends when they go to the digital world and it's during summer and everything. So August 1st has to be in between in the middle of the events of Chapter 3. So like that, whatever, this movie like doesn't interface with the reboot whatsoever. So it's like, on the one hand, that's fine. The other hand, it's like some of these like talks about like, oh, looking back at their memories to move forward and stuff. I'm like, you can consider that like ironic or like pathetic fallacy. No, that's not what I mean. Anyway, that we know more information on than the characters. But on the other hand, it's also just like awkward. It just doesn't, this doesn't fit in the timeline, because then the end, they go off to search for Makemon in the digital world, which isn't a thing that happens in that way. Like they end up in the digital world because the event is a movie. It's its own timeline. It's its own weirdness.
Yep.
But I feel like this, I don't know, it's like, because it's a standalone thing that can't really change the status quo, it is introspective in a way that's good, and in a way that, like I mentioned before, trying to not change the status quo has not been generally good. And the last note on that front is that, like, so much of this movie focused on them talking about their futures and their where they want to be and stuff, and the last Try movie is named Mirai. So I'm just like, it means future. It's titled Future. So I'm like, how?
Which means we can skip it and just believe in this, right?
That is kind of like my point is kind of, yeah, like how is it not possible? This has to be stepping on the toes of that, right? Or like,
well, it's not canon,
I guess. But like,
stage plays are never canon.
It's not that it's not canon. It's like, I feel like that the last movie will inevitably bring up similar things and do them much worse. And it'll step on the toes in the sense that we'll all be like, this is unsatisfying because the stage play did this better, which would be a weird way to end Try.
I mean, did we really expect anything less?
We didn't expect the stage
play. Or rather, did we expect anything more?
No, I guess not. I just feel like, yeah, probably Try isn't even going to be that much introspective. It's probably going to like be titled Future because there's going to be a time skip. And that's probably about it. That's my guess now.
Ooh, don't break my heart even worse.
I do want to
expectations even more.
So now that we're in the spoiler section, we can talk about highlights from the curtain call. We can talk about, I guess we didn't talk about the, you mentioned you want to talk about the puppet that was a spoiler. So you're probably talking about
Metal Greymon. Yes, puppet. Oh, snaps. How many people were doing it?
Right, my favorite part of Metal Greymon was the
five.
If you watch the curtain call, in the curtain call, they like go through and list. I guess it's the puppeteer.
I was Metal Greymon's right leg.
Yeah. I was Metal Greymon's left leg. I was the trident.
He was a big bit. It was a big puppet, and it was great.
And one of the highlights.
It was awesome.
One of the highlights of the second DVD is that, like, in one of the behind the scenes things, you can see them like rehearsing, and you can see that there are like two people, like either people in the legs, people behind, like you can see all that stuff. It's kind of like
fall.
I didn't see that.
Oh.
I loved in the curtain call hearing, I guess it was Palmon's puppeteer saying that so they're all like, I was Metal Greymon's left leg, I was Metal Greymon's right leg. Oh, yeah. And then Palmon's puppeteer is like, I was Metal Greymon's important bits, or like testicles, I think is what she was basically getting at.
She said his sensitive bits or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Made a gesture to illustrate what she meant. And I was like, oh my God.
Wait a second.
And it's funny because like they don't list any other Metal Greymon parts. I don't think it was a much less complicated puppet. Like I don't think it really did like had much motion. Yeah, I think it just like moved around. So I think this is like, you just get this like, here are these like five people that were Metal Greymon's every little bit of anatomy, and the only Metal Greymon part was the sensitive bits.
His balls.
Oh boy. I also really liked Yamato's actor. He like articulated that in, and this is something I didn't realize, there, I'll have a link in the show notes actually to an Answer Man column on ANN about stage plays and the popularity, and apparently they are like heavily a female audience kind of thing, which I guess like they're more for the Fujoshi market. Apparently they, one of the big ones in the past that like solidified the stage play anime adaptation market was Prince of Tennis, and apparently it was a very, very, very Fujoshi themed stage play. The Yamato's actor like thanks the fact that they're like, it's not just women, there are lots of men and children and foreigners, and then foreigners. Yeah, but then also he ends his speech by being like, he says, don't say goodbye, because that was sweet. Okay. Also, I couldn't remember which Try movie has that as the ending song. Boku ni Tote.
I don't know,
I just look it up, doesn't really matter. And there were a couple more highlights from the DVD extra DVD 2 that people might not have seen. First of all, just like loading that in and like playing it from the beginning, it doesn't like introduce you or anything. It's just like, here is random footage of people rehearsing. And the most bizarre thing is seeing the people without their full costume and everything. Cause like, I don't want to say that they all look the same because that's super racist, but like,
but that's how I feel.
No, but like, I mean, the costumes they have are like designed to make them look different. You know, like everyone has different colored hair. They have really a big elaborate hair. And like, particularly the male actors, most of them all have like this, a similar like hair down to their eyebrow, all like long, a little bit wavy hair. I think actually Tai Chi, one of the actors, I can't remember which one, actually has like hair that's a little bit longer than that and it parts. And that's like, everyone else has like similar kind of hairstyle. And like, once you see them like talking and stuff, you can see, oh wait, I recognize the face now. But it's just weird to see like, they all look so colorful. And it's like, oh wait, this is like at first when I was watching them do stuff, I was like, is this the second, the replacements, or what's it called when you have understudies?
Understudy.
Yeah. I was like, maybe it's the understudies. And I was like, no, this is just them without their full getup. Huh. This is what they really look like. It's interesting. And there's a moment they do lots of like weird behind the scenes shenanigans because the cameras are rolling for the DVD extras. But this one's around 45 minutes in. Yamato's actor and Nimi's actor are playing around behind stage, and Yamato pretends to be Palmon and like does like a little devolution to Togemon, and like it's really cute. But it shows that like they know not, because like Togemon isn't even in the stage play at all. Yeah. And so like, but he does Palmon voice, like spins around and starts punching his Togemon. I was like, oh, that's really sweet. They're cute. Also, whenever they like start the production, like before they go on stage, the cast all stands around in a circle, and Tai Chi says Digimon Adventure, and they all put their foot in the middle and say try. It's sweet.
Oh.
Also, there's like a moment, I guess, where the Edamon 5 run backstage, I guess when they're coming on stage or coming off stage. And at various points, some of the other actors like follow along and they're like, they pretend to be a monkey and they're like, it's Edamon 6 now.
I didn't like that they call it the Edamon 5, where Edamon is one of the five, because he'd be like, Edamon 5, go do a thing. And then only four would leave. And I'm like, that doesn't work.
Wow. Wow.
Ow.
We are doing the free online gender quiz. We have picked four characters we are going to be figuring out the gender of. We're going to be doing Edamon, the PPAP guy, Metal Greymon Puppet, and the stage play audience. We'll be finding out the genders of these four important characters to this stage play. So Ash, what is this quiz?
It is the free online gender quiz at mkremons.github.io/genderquiz. Have you ever wondered what your gender was? Fortunately, you've come to the right place. This free online gender quiz will tell you everything you need to know about your gender. Just answer all the questions as truthfully as you can, and all will be revealed. ...
All right.
So I'm not reading the questions this time. Just,
yeah, we figured we'd cut that anyway.
Follow along at home.
So we'll just have the results for you in a minute. All right. So now we are back after having filled out this thorough quiz. Ashley, let's start off with you. What is Edamon's gender?
Cube. Your gender is a three-dimensional solid object bounded by six square faces, facets, or sides, with three meeting at each vertex. It is the only regular hexahedron and is one of the five platonic solids. It has six faces, 12 edges, and eight vertices.
Nice, nice, nice. And I have the PPAP guy. The PPAP guy is bees! Accompanied by the gif of of Oprah unleashing bees onto her audience. And people, it's the Cars gif, but transposed with bees on top of them.
Yes.
If people have not seen it before, that's all there is for PPAP guy. Andrew.
I'm going to jump in with the audience, because the audience also got bees. Flash, 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 bees, 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 bees.
And then the Metal Greymon puppet got tubs from Neko Atsume. That's it.
I need to look up which one this is.
Is the fat cat.
Those are genders. So Edamon is cube gender. PPAP guy and the stage play audience are both bees gender. And Metal Greymon puppet is tubs from Neko Atsume gender. Well, Welcome to Recommendation Articulation. This is our segment where we plug things we want to hug and we hug things we want to plug. And we just tell you things that we think you will enjoy, because if you listen to this, you might have good taste. I hope so. And we have good taste. We have the best taste.
Do I? I don't know about that.
Ashley, you start off. You have
me.
1 minute.
No, I don't have. I don't know.
Okay. Andrew, you start off. You have 1 minute to recommend something.
Okay, I'm going to do Crypt of the Necrodancer, which is a roguelike rhythm game, RPG hybrid. Hmm. And basically, you just go around pressing the arrow keys and hoping to kill stuff that are trying to kill you to the beat.
What is it on? Like, cell phone game?
It's on PC, PS4, Vita, etc. I think it's being ported to the Switch. But yes, it is a dungeon crawler roguelike rhythm game.
And are you playing with just the keyboard?
No, I'm playing with a controller because I'm on the PS4.
Oh, okay.
Also, for some reason, there's Danganronpa characters that are available in music.
Mm.
Okay.
Okay, now you...
Because when I initially heard about this game, it was in regards to it being playable with a DDR controller.
Yes, you can do that.
What?
It's what? An easier
Ashley,
mode.
We need this game.
We need this game now, Ashley.
Also, it is the most unforgiving game ever.
Good.
Okay. Asher, you have 1 minute.
All right. I've got yet another cell phone game, because that's what I'm limited to out here. It's called Hungry Hearts Diner, A Tale of Star-Crossed Souls, available on both, what? On both Android and the Apple Store. And by Android, I mean the Play Store. It's a very easy sort of clicking game where there's no stress involved. You're a little old lady who's running this diner after your husband has sort of taken ill, and you listen to, well, first you're going to try to get better at making food, because this was your husband's diner. You're not that great a cook. But you get better. And as you get better and you make your customers happy, they start talking to you about their problems and you help them. And it's really sweet. It's a pretty short game, but like the art is adorable, and I finished it, and I haven't had the heart to delete it off my phone. So you should play it.
Okay, Ashley, I wrote in Clear Card Arc for you.
I saw that.
Are you comfortable with that?
I'm too lazy to fight that. So okay. Sure.
you have 1 minute to recommend something that I told you to recommend.
Yep. So yesterday, Jeff and I watched Cardcaptor Sakura Clear Card Arc first episode, and it was disgustingly cute. So yeah, Asher,
I still have to watch it. Yeah,
God, Asher, get on it.
I went to class today. What do you want from me?
Rah, 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 rah. I don't care. Yeah, disgustingly cute. Still easy to follow. It's made for children. New cards, same Sakura and Shaoran. Yep.
It murdered Crunchyroll.
It murdered Crunchyroll. It's that popular. So, you know, if you got to get in on that hype.
Yep.
Yeah.
I guess quick PSA for people who aren't aware. If you are like desperate to watch new shows on Crunchyroll as soon as they air and there's some big thing, like, I mean, the fact that Dragon Ball Super and Cardcaptor Sakura are going to air around the same time every week probably means this will happen.
Within 20 minutes of each other.
Yeah, it probably means this will happen regularly. If you're okay with not watching on all devices, you can link your Crunchyroll account to a VRV account and watch through VRV, which I think has generally better infrastructure in general, like more resources and things. So I don't think they go down as frequently as Crunchyroll itself goes down. But also the VRV is something a lot of people don't know. The Crunchyroll mobile app can't, at least on iOS, I assume it's the same situation on Android, but I'm not 100% sure. The Crunchyroll mobile app can't download videos to watch offline, but the VRV app does and can. So if there's something wrong with the Crunchyroll servers and you can't watch Cardcaptor Sakura, you can download it for offline viewing on your phone on Verve. And anyway, that's a neat hack, but only helps if you aren't, you know, don't need to watch it. Because I think Crunchyroll is still on more devices than VRV. Anyway, I'm going to recommend something. Okay, I'm going to recommend a bizarre thing, a bizarre media entity called Final Fantasy XIV Dad of Light, which is a Netflix show that is such a strange, it's a strange hybrid of Japanese drama, like a J-drama, with, you know, like stitched together footage of Final Fantasy XIV into a narrative. It is essentially, I mean, once you figure it out, it's like, it is an advertisement for Final Fantasy XIV. It is an advertisement for Final Fantasy XIV that takes the form of a heartfelt touching story of a child, not child, he's like an adult, a working age adult, and his father, and trying to get to know his father, who is very distant, they barely talk, trying to get to know his father through getting him introduced into Final Fantasy XIV, and then becoming friends in the game online together without him knowing that it's him, and seeing the side of his dad, and getting to know more about him in a way that he does not open up normally. And it's surprisingly heartfelt, and also the humor is the most bizarre thing at moments, where like the humor just comes from the fact that it is events are happening in an in-game MMO engine. It is bizarre, and it's great. It's not like, I think it starts off being amazing and eventually dips a little bit. It's not like 100% firing all cylinders until the end, but it's still pretty good. And it's only like 7 episodes. There's an 8th episode on Netflix. Don't watch it. It's very boring. It's like half recap, half an original story that's just MMO, but it is not good. Okay. This has been Podigis T801, covering the Digimon Tri Stage Play August 1st adventure. If you like the stage play, you should go buy it if you have not already. It's on DVD, available through Amazon Japan or CD Japan. I think currently, as the time of this recording, CD Japan, it's backordered on there, but there are several copies on Amazon Japan. So if you like it, if you have money to spare, please do that. It helps encourage more things being created for Digimon. Digimon is not a very big fandom. Making purchases for this kind of thing does a lot to help things get created. I think the price is around $70, depending on where you buy it, which seems really high for a DVD. It's not even a Blu-ray, it's a DVD. But that's like, I think tickets, if you were to buy an actual seat to the stage play, were about $70 starting there. And you had to like go through this whole lottery process and everything. So anyway, you're getting a pretty good thing, and it's supporting a good cause, which is Digimon. And do that. So anyway, if you have any thoughts on this episode, if you want to tell us who the best character in this movie, not movie, in the stage play was, if we're wrong for saying Joe, or what we missed.
We're definitely not wrong for saying Joe.
There is no such thing as ever being wrong about saying Joe.
Or if you want to let us know your favorite moments in the stage play, maybe there are moments you thought were amazing which you didn't mention, you can send all of your thoughts to podigis.com/T801. You can also send your thoughts to us on Twitter, Tumblr, or Facebook, where we are Podigis, and you can email them to podigis@gmail.com. You can reply to our With the Will thread or our Digimon subreddit thread. Or you can lock yourself in a pocket dimension where you are always sending us feedback, because then we will totally get it.
Special thanks to Extra Animon for our Season 5 Agumon logo, and to our prodigious Patreon supporters who help make everything we do possible. Special thanks go out to our current champion Patrimon, Diab Jomon, the infamous Tokujo on Twitter, Joe Kido, Hylunamon, Sam Kuagamon, who's also on the Moncast, and our ultimate Patrimon, Andy Lusamon, who is at Tamer Theory on Twitter and is making a cool Digimon comic at tamertheory.com. You know, Tamer Theory everywhere, just look it up. David Graumon, and our mega Patrimon, Punchy Punch Punch Punch, Marcus.
If people want to follow us on social media, Ashley, where can people find you?
I am at AshMcD00 on Twitter, and you should listen to my Shoujo podcast, Shoujo and Tell.
If people want more Asher in their diet, where can they find you, Asher?
They can find me accidentally turning off my mic when it was on. I'm Asher Dashery at Tumblr. If you want to see a lot Final Fantasy 15 art,
you can listen to our episodes about Maid Sama now.
Yeah, I am Shoujo also on. I'm also on Shoujo and Tell.
That's right.
Yeah,
looks like you Shoujo and Told.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
You should actually, you should make, you should like print stickers that say Shoujo and Told and send it to your past guests. Okay. Like, I Shoujo and Told.
No.
If people need a little bit of Andrew in their life, where can they find you?
Oh, you can't have it.
There's no love here. There's no love.
Is this a reference?
No, maybe. You're not asking me where you can find me. You're just asking me nothing.
He's at Drew Softman at Twitter or something.
I was going to wait until there's a... Okay, and I am Jeffling Jeff on Twitter, and Podigis is Podigis everywhere that you look it up.
Share the podcast with the 5 puppeteers handling your important bits. And don't share the podcast with, quote, friends, unquote, who would turn up to camp without a single article of camping equipment. They're not your friends.
Bye.
Bye.
And remember, never stop digivolving.
What is this, T-801?
Yeah.
It took me a while to realize what that meant.
Well, we went from T-1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we jumped to 801. It's our 801st episode special.
Right.
I just said episode. So,
it's, you know, August 1st, 801.
I get it.
Share the podcast with the five puppeteers handling your important bits. And don't share the podcast with, quote, friends, unquote, who would turn up to camp without a single article of camping equipment. They're not your friends.
She was thinking for a good cause.
You know she wasn't.
There was a Combini. I wish I could go camping, which is a Combini right next door. Actually, on that note, I kind of wish I had recommended. There's a new anime. There's a new anime during the season called Laid Back.
Is it Eurocamp?
Yeah, Eurocamp. That I accidentally watched getting accused of a different anime. And I was like, why is this so highly praised? Which normally is a bad thing, but I ended up like after like 5 minutes being like, I'm totally sold on this anime. Which is just about like...
What did you mix it up with?
I got confused with a place further than the universe or whatever.
You mean farther?
No, I wish it were farther. hot topic on the Jeff and Jeff Twitter feed. But
that's what I should have made a share bit.
What?
I should have made hot topic people share bit.
But yeah, Eurocamp / Laidback Camp is just about like chill girls. There's only the first episode is about the main one girl. And
the
like,
other one.
Yeah, and the other ones there a little bit.
Forgot camping equipment.
I guess so. But I never had any interest in camping until watching this. And I was like, oh, you can just be like chill and like sitting, reading a book with a campfire.
It's not fun. It's not fun.
It's not. It's not worth it, Jeff.
It's always more fun when anime does it.
Exactly. Yes. That's why you can't trust anime.
Anime's real life. Don't lie to me.